Community Radio.
On behalf of the entire KBOO community, we'd like to offer our sincerest thanks for your contribution to KBOO's end-of-year membership drive. We challenged KBOO supporters to help us meet 3 donation matches and raise $45,000, and you stepped up. Your generous support, combined with hundreds of other community radio donors, helped to raise $85,000 for KBOO. We knew you could do it, and together we did.
Welcome to Art Talk Bus Stop, a monthly youth-centered podcast about how artists do their work and make a living. I'm Nicole Cabrera.
And I'm Ayana Ross.
And I'm Erica Thomas, and today we're welcoming Mike Crenshaw to the show. Mike, welcome to Art Talk Bus Stop.
Thanks for having me. Hello, everybody.
Hello. We're excited to have you. So do you want to tell us a little first about who you are and what you do?
Sure. I'm a cultural activist. So if I was to break that one term down, then I'm an educator, an activist, and an artist. And I use hip-hop culture and music and spoken word to engage students and audiences in the discussion, really. The lyrical content of my music is often in alignment and parallel to the types of subjects that I focus on in the classroom, which is really about the root causes of the conditions that we face in society. I believe that a lot of what we're experiencing has roots in history, and we can trace our day-to-day experiences to things that have been part of the lives that lots of folks that come before us have lived. And I think that it's important to have that perspective. So in that regard, I'm a teaching artist at 3 different high schools right now. I'm at Alliance at Meek, Alliance at Benson, and MLC, and I do project-based learning, music projects and podcast projects with youth. And then I also, you know, record, market, promote, perform, share my music with the world locally, nationally, and internationally.
Great. Go ahead, Nicole. I can see you ready. You're ready. Go for it.
Yeah. can you tell us a bit more about sort of your upbringing and kind of where you come from for the people who don't know about you? Just so I can get a little perspective.
Surely. I'm from Chicago originally. So I was born in the early childhood years in Chicago. And then I moved around a lot around the Chicago area, lived in some smaller cities in Illinois, Joliet, Springfield. And then my family relocated to Minnesota. So then I lived in St. Paul and Minneapolis. And I graduated high school in Minneapolis. And then I moved to Portland in my 20s. And so at this point, I've lived in Portland, Oregon longer than any of the other places I live. But my heart, I think of so much of my development happened in the Midwest. A lot of me still identifies with being from the Midwest. In my high school years in Minneapolis, Minnesota, I became politically active and have been pretty consistently. Since then, the political activism I got involved with was my friends, me, deciding to take a stand against racist gangs that were operating inside of our communities. And so we organized a network of people to respond to that racist threat of violence. And that became the foundation of what was called Anti-Racist Action, which went on to become a national organization. And so that work that I did as a teenager ultimately informed the work I later started to do as an artist and the work that I do in classrooms.
I wanted to talk a bit about your music. I listened to some of your music, and it, like you said, it's very focused on being politically active and fighting these causes that a lot of people face, day to day. And I was curious, how did you begin to become involved in combining those two sort of concepts together, like hip hop music and political issues in current?
Well, it started as a child and going through a lot of experiences that I felt were unjust, unfair, wrong. And that began to build in me a desire for, I guess, what would later I would later understand was justice or social justice. You know, being made fun of, being bullied, encountering racism. These things started to make me want to know why. Like, what were the root causes of these things that didn't feel right? And as I started to ask those questions, I began to encounter reading material or older activists who would take on the role of mentors in my development. And they began to give me a political education about the historic roots of some of the things that I was facing in the community and in my day-to-day life. And one of the things that a few elders said to me that really stuck with me and that I began to seek out in terms of my education and consciousness was like, they were like, Mike, you can fight racism, you know, you can use violence to confront these guys, but the racism that you're trying to fight is a symptom, and there's something deeper at the root. And so they began to encourage me to look at the root cause of conditions. And that's when I really started to become politically active in a way that was deeper than just reacting to what I perceived as injustice. And did I answer your question?
Yeah, part of it. The second part is like, where did the involvement of hip hop come from? You kind of started there where you were like, you know, you could fight racism. You can't fight racism with violence, or you can, sorry, you can fight racism with violence, but really there's a deeper issue. And so you were kind of going off of
that. Thanks for reminding me. And thanks for the question too. And so while I was doing this, we're talking about the 80s into the 90s, there was also like a musical soundtrack. In that, in hardcore punk music and in certain elements of hip hop music, there were artists that we were listening to were talking about the things that we were feeling and thinking. And bands like, let's say, the Dead Kennedys was like a punk band that was really critical. A lot of punk bands were really critical of authority and governments and systems. And then in hip hop, we had like Boogie Down Productions and X-Clan and Public Enemy. And so there were these songs and these albums that were kind of encouraging and reinforcing the way that the youth movement was feeling and thinking. And so that helped me later when I decided to start taking music seriously as an artist in my own right. It helped me to go, well, if I don't want to talk about what the guys were, you know, talking about selling dope and killing people, materialism, if I don't want to talk about that because that's not an accurate reflection of who I am, maybe I can talk about the things that I actually think about and that I am passionate about. Having had those examples of other artists doing that kind of helped me to choose to do the same thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I also noticed that within some of the music videos that you specifically sent to us, it not only shares sort of your story and the history that is behind racism, but you also share other people and other groups of people than their story. And I wanted to know, how do you go about collaborating with these people, and what is the importance for you to also share and collaborate with others to tell?
It's an extension of growing up in community with people. You know, there were times in my life where I moved around a lot. And when I felt like when I was young, I moved around too much. I was always the new kid on the block, always had to struggle to make new friends in school, never really felt like I fit in until I got involved in the hardcore punk scene. And that was where the first time I started to feel comfortable in my own skin, because it was amongst other kids who didn't fit in that we found and formed our own little community. And so when we started getting involved in this violent struggle against these white supremacists and neo-Nazis, we really needed each other. You know, the sense of community we had wasn't just an ideal, it was very practical, because we had to reach out and form alliances with people who had the same views that we had for our very survival. And so I learned at a young age in my teenage years that there was not only strength in numbers, but that we could get more done if we worked together. And that even though we all might not identify the same, there were a lot of things that we had in common. And so my group of friends was actually people of a lot of different ethnicities, people of different sexual orientations, and we actually learned to stick up for each other. So now, being an artist, I kind of take some of those same values into how I work in the community. And there's two ways that that works for me. One is I see what I have in common with my colleagues, with my comrades, with my contemporaries, and I'm going to be not only invested in my own success, but in the success of those I share community with. And then the other is this mentorship aspect, because, you know, while I was doing what I was doing, there were some adults who really cared for me, and to the degree that they said, look, man, if you keep doing things the way you're doing them, you're going to be dead or you're going to be in prison. So we want to support you, but we want to figure out how to support you in ways where you can do what you do more constructively. And those are the people who offered me, those were some teachers at the alternative high school that I graduated from. They offered me my first teaching job. And so while I was still a senior in high school, in their own way to try to like protect my very life, they're putting tools in my hand and teaching me how to create curriculum and giving me a way out of some of the destructive things that I was doing. So now, in, you know, while I'm doing this work as a teaching artist and a mentor, I feel like I'm just kind of doing the same thing for others that people did for me.
Ayana, do you want to jump in here? You got some questions?
I don't know. You guys kind of went over some of it. But like, as I was reading the email, I was reading like the topics that, you know, you were comfortable talking about. And I was like, art, okay, activism, hip hop culture. And I was like, global exchange.
Yeah.
And so I was just wondering how exactly that interest came about, I guess.
Thanks for asking. That's a really important aspect of my work. And it's so near and dear to my heart, because when I was a kid, my mom took us on a couple of road trips across the country to visit her friends. And that, I just remember looking out the window and the first time I saw mountains, you know, just being so amazed and fascinated by the landscapes and the sights. And then another thing that was very influential was my grandmother. Her and my grandpa traveled around the world, because my grandfather worked for an airline called Northwest Airlines. So whenever I would stay at their house, they would have like pictures and postcards and souvenirs from all their travels. And they had a globe and it had all these little push pins on it from all the different places they visited, in Asia and the Caribbean. And so I always wanted to see the world. And when I started doing hip hop music, I always wanted to tour the world. The political activism that I was engaged in actually helped me get invited to Africa when I was in my earlier 30s. In 2004, I got to go to Rwanda, and that was the first time I went to Africa. I'd done some travel before that, but it was really just more as a tourist. But when I got to go to Rwanda, I was invited to participate in this conference on HIV/AIDS and youth empowerment and economic justice, as well as genocide reconciliation. And the conditions of my participation in the conference was that I had to do a project related to the outcomes of the conference. And so some of the African comrades that I met invited me to help them build a computer center in Central Africa. And so I came back to Portland, and I didn't really know how it was going to help, but I figured in order to do it, I had to do it and incorporate something I love. And so we started throwing hip hop concerts to raise the money to ship the computers.
Nice.
And we were successful. And that computer center has expanded into 3 different sites in this country, Burundi, Central Africa. And that work got me invited back to Africa to do a music festival. And first time was 2004. And then in 2012, I got to go do a music festival in Zimbabwe. And there I met people who were fond of the work we had accomplished. And they invited me to participate in this international tour called the African Hip Hop Caravan. So I started going there every year and toured in Tanzania, Kenya, Zimbabwe, and South Africa. And that was like a dream come true. You know, I was able to see things I'd only read about, you know, in magazines, and meet people, and, you know, being in like a city I've never been to, and getting up early and getting a cup of coffee and just watching people and like hearing the sounds and, you know, seeing the different vegetation. That I love that so much, you know. And so that work just led to me being able to have relationships with people all over. And I was able to go to Cuba and Russia and Germany and do the same kind of thing. And now that the pandemic has limited our ability to travel, I've actually done some of the same stuff virtually. Ultimately, I want to take groups of young people to do this. I've only been able to take three younger people with me. I've taken 2 high school students to tour on the African Hip Hop Caravan. But the last time we were able to go was in 2018. But I'll hope the work to continue to develop the work and then eventually be able to take groups of students.
Yeah. As you were saying, you know, you like the views and stuff. I can relate. That also reminded me of like in the first of the links, I forgot what it was called.
You can pull it up.
Yeah.
The Earthbound in the Arctic.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
It kind of opens as, and it's like this field. And you just see the mic right there. Like, the view was beautiful. And then I liked seeing the mic kind of in the middle of that.
So that was in the Arctic Circle in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. And that was an amazing trip. You know, being from Chicago and Minneapolis, I never imagined I'd want to go to Alaska. Because the winter out there is so cold. I'm like, why would I want to go to winter? But this brother that I work with, Chad Brown, fascinating story. He started Soul River Inc. and Soul River Runs Deep. He's a combat veteran, and he had severe PTSD, and he learned that a lot of combat veterans that have PTSD have a lot in common with young people who been through very tough situations who also have PTSD. So he started putting combat vets and youth together and taking them on these trips. And that's how he got involved with going to the Arctic. And then later he started something called a nonprofit called Love is King to help sexual minorities and people of color feel safe in the outdoors, because he was actually shot at by a racist while he was out fly fishing. And I got to go on one of their first trips up to the Arctic. So when we were up there, he was like, yo, I have an idea to do this video. And he wanted to do exactly what you saw. He wanted to take a microphone and put it in the middle of the tundra. So he brought that mic up there with us and we plugged it into the ground, you know, to symbolize that we were speaking, like giving voice to the earth. And it was amazing, because we were there in July. It didn't get that hot where we were at, but it didn't get very cold either. And the sun was up like 24 hours a day. Yeah, I mean, there were a couple of days, but like there was a day in Fairbanks, it was like 85 degrees. And I never knew that it could get that warm in the Arctic, you know?
Wild.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Did you hear the mosquitoes? Did you have it up loud enough?
I don't think so, but I want to
know
back now.
We're recording.
What? Yeah. I didn't hear it either.
Yeah. I saw that.
Okay, maybe that was it. You could see him. I can hear him. Very yeah. Good.
I mean, knowing how post-production goes, I'm pretty sure he probably edited them out for the.
Yeah, do you all want to talk a little bit about like kind of the nuts and bolts? That's usually we like to cover some content stuff and yeah, history, your history, but also you know, part of what we're doing here is a peek behind the curtain. Like, how do artists literally make the thing that you've seen? So maybe would you share with us a little bit about your process for writing lyrics? And also potentially some behind the scenes of how you do things like create albums, like what is your production process for those and for your music videos?
Yeah, it always starts with inspiration. So I'm pretty busy. Sometimes I work 16-hour days because what I do at my day job, it's good work. I enjoy it, but my creative work often has to take place in addition to my day job. And so sometimes I'm up pretty late trying to capture the inspiration that comes throughout the course of a day. Inspiration for me as a writer and a lyricist comes to hearing what's going on in the world. Sometimes I could hear another song and get inspired by that. You know, what's a funny thing that happens is sometimes I'll hear people say something, I'll be listening to the news, and I'll hear them say something, but I will actually mishear what they said. And then I'll be like, oh my God, that's not even what they said. But that word would actually rhyme with the word that they did say. And then that'll become the basic rhyme. So sometimes, you know, I try to be safer. I'll have to pull over and write it down in my phone. So songs like 16 bar verses, right? Whole verses for songs are often little bits and pieces of ideas that come to me as I'm living my life that I write down, and then I have to remember to make time to put them together. If I was to go into the notes section of my computer, into that app and into my phone, there's like literally hundreds of pages of just ideas that I take those ideas and patch them together. Another way that inspiration comes is I work with a lot of beat producers and musicians who are just phenomenal. And they'll share with me beats, and I'll listen to those beats. And they just start, if I'm in the right mood and my mind is open, then ideas start to flow from that. So the songs I end up writing are either, you know, inspiration that comes in the moment while I'm listening to the music of the people I collaborate with, or taking ideas that I've already written down, you know, that came to me, and then seeing if they work rhythmically with the music that I'm trying to pair it together with. And then once I write them, I tend to record in my phone. As you guys know, how like if you listen to a song long enough, you know it by heart without even trying.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. You might be in the grocery store, hearing something wrong, and you start singing along, right? The way that I memorize my work so that I can go perform it is I listen to it on repeat. So I'll read it into the phone with the music in the background, and then I'll listen to it over and over and over, and eventually I can do it, and that becomes the basis of performance. That practice also helps when I'm in the studio recording. It helps me to deliver my vocal performance with more I guess energy and finesse the more I have it memorized.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like people don't realize how hard it is to like actually like, you know, either sing or rap or deliver lines to a song that doesn't even have words on it yet. Like, I don't think people realize how hard that gets. And I think it's kind of cool that like most of your stuff comes to you in like bits and pieces, because I was speaking with Erica before we started recording. I was like, how does he come up with these like words? Like, they all like rhyme and they sound good, and like I'm just like, it's like, how are people creatively talented to put these little bits and pieces together? And sometimes there is no real explanation, and it's just, you know, like you said, it just comes to you. I think that's really cool. I wish I could do that.
We can do anything that we desire. I think it's the application. Mm-hmm. And what has allowed me to, you know, apply myself is that I enjoy it. It's a sense of enjoyment that's that's part of the work that allows me to practice about it and keep doing it. And I'm always competing against myself. I'm always trying to outdo my last work. A student once asked me, Mr. Crenshaw, who's your favorite rapper? And I was like, I'm still trying to be my favorite rapper. So I don't feel, I love anyone that's good. I love to hear rappers that are so good that they make me want to be better. And you know, the simple rhymes, like I like multi-syllabic rhymes. So one I just penned recently was like, oh, this is so simple and perfect. How come I didn't write this 10 years ago? But it's only the lived experience of doing the work I was doing, which is similar to what all three of you are doing right now. And it was record the report, broadcast the podcast. And I was like, how simple. It's what we're doing, right?
Deliver the rain, the waves, subconscious rhythm, liberate the slave, the awesome and the awful, the path is paved. Thoughts prophesize, I philosophize, saw through the eyes of the strong and the wise, destined for death, some are petrified, thunderclap cracks and electrifies, wet leaves on the trees reflect the sky, the OG with the reason to testify, example, speak truth, more ample than words, then you take the route that you can't disturb, respect the process, success, and God bless, we participate, as we observe, interact with the fact that God search, earth, air, fire, water, spirit, merge.
I actually also wanted to know a bit more about like your music video process. I know we talked about the video earlier, but that was something that someone brought to you. When it comes to filming other music videos for personal work, how do you go about that? Like who do you call? Who do you contact? You know?
Well, how do you make music videos? Being an artist, you eventually meet other people who are doing similar work, either in a field that intersects with yours. A lot of guys that I work with that are also MCs eventually became videographers as well, because what they found was whenever they wanted to make videos, there was never anyone there that could do it the way they wanted to do it, or they couldn't afford to pay the cost that were charging. So they begin to write grants and, you know, get funding and get their own equipment and do videos themselves. And so because of that, I have a handful of artists that I work with that I've relied on to do my videos with me. We shoot everything ourselves. I rely on some of those same folks to edit. I don't know how to do that. You know, I haven't made the commitment to become a videographer, but I'm encouraged and inspired by people I know who are good at that. There's organization. Big shout out to Outside the Frame. Outside the Frame is a nonprofit that teaches young people like yourselves how to shoot, you know, direct, edit videos and short films. So eventually I just had enough connections with people in the community to be able to collaborate with them to do the work and make the videos.
I'm horrible with names, even when it comes to my own music that I listen to. But there was one, and there was a motorcycle gang in there, was it not? I was just curious, how did that like come together?
So I was a member of a motorcycle club. And those were my brothers, and you know, I love riding in community with my comrades, and that was at a time in my life where I was deep into the lifestyle, and it occurred to me, and you'll see this repeated in a lot of my other videos, we live in one of the most beautiful parts of the country, you know, and while other people are always trying to shoot videos inside of, you know, nightclubs and throwing around money and stuff. I was like, you know, just look outdoors. We, you know, I'm not gonna try to outdo you with cars and stuff, but I'm gonna show you how beautiful the area you live in is. And so I, riding with like 30, 40 people in formation is like, it's something else, you know? So I was like, let me share this with the world. So that's what we did. It was fun shooting it. We didn't have a big production team. We had basically one camera guy, and we got a car and another guy to drive, an assistant camera guy to drive. So those guys would either be driving behind us, alongside of us, or in front of us, and one person would be hanging out the window with the camera.
Amazing.
Yes.
Right. That dedication.
Yeah, you need that. That's how we get it done.
The way you were talking about how you form your lyrics and your rhymes, how does that go for your poetry? Like, is it maybe the same?
Yeah, so there's an innate sense of rhythm that we have because we breathe, right, and our heart beats. And so there's this involuntary rhythm that drives a lot of our life if we just pay attention to it. When I was a kid, I noticed a couple of times I'd be listening to the radio and somebody else would be on the telephone. And then without the person who was on the phone trying, I'd be like, it almost sounds like they're talking to the beat, you know? But that was one thing I noticed early on about the rhythm with which we speak. You know, we pause, we breathe. Our volume has dynamics, we go up and down. And so, in about 1996, I was working at a restaurant, and I'd already been writing, but they had the National Poetry Slam Championships at the restaurant I was working at. So while I was working, I was listening to all these spoken word artists, and I heard an artist by the name of Saul Williams perform. And I was so inspired by what he did, I signed up and like joined the competition the next day. And what it was that he did was with his voice, he was doing a lyrical performance that was more powerful than anything I ever heard with music, just him talking on the microphone. And so from that point on, I've written everything that I do in a way that I want it to be able to stand alone and be just as powerful, or even sometimes more powerful than it is with musical accompaniment. So all my lyrics that are performing in music, I perform the same things without me. So, you know, rap is just rhythm and poetry, literally. Yep.
And with your poetry, where do you publish that? Do you publish it online, or do you actually make print books, or how do you share that with people?
You know, I just record. I have some, there's a cappella recordings on some of the albums I've released. There's live video of it that's on YouTube, or like the Earthbound poem that, is that Earthbound poem that I did in the Arctic actually has a whole other video that has a beat to it, has music to it. I have not published a lot of work. I'm working on two books right now. And that's been one of the more difficult undertakings in my life is working on writing a book. Because writing a book, even though I write a lot of music, making the time that it takes to consistently write enough to finish a book is a bit different of a practice for me, you know? And it's not like, the music comes from inspiration. And to me, that's easy. There's a lot of inspiration, but in writing the book, there's this extra step that's really time consuming. And the only way to get it done is to be consistent. That's been the challenge, but I'm committed. I'm hoping that once I finish my first two books, that it'll be a little bit easier to continue to write in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really hard to maintain that discipline. I have not written a book, but I can understand from other types of projects that just require that daily practice of just getting up and doing it every day so that you don't procrastinate and let it slide.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to talk with us at all about the content of those books, or you want to stick more to, yeah.
So the life, there's a podcast you all might be interested in called It Did Happen Here. I don't know if you got to check that out at all.
I sent it to him. Yeah. I've listened. It's yeah.
So we've got a book we're working on for that podcast. And then there's another book I'm working on that's just my autobiographical memoir. And so the same publishing company is releasing both books. And that's what I'm working on. The book that is my autobiographical memoir is just my experience of becoming politicized and ultimately being a founder of these organizations and this anti-racist action movement.
I wanted to ask about the podcast that you do that you mentioned. Can you tell us a bit about how it sort of came together? Like who came to who and said, hey, let's do this project.
I think sure. That'd be a great idea. So there's a man by the name of David Gilbert who was a political prisoner. He went to jail in the 70s, I think, late 70s or 1980. For a bank robbery. He was a getaway driver in a bank robbery. Really interesting story. They thought he was never really, a lot of us thought he would never get out of prison, but his sentence was just commuted. His son is actually the district attorney in San Francisco. So David Gilbert was a member of the Weather Underground and a supporter of the Black Liberation Army, which was a militant formation that was related to the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. He wrote a book called Love and Struggle while he was in prison, and when it was time for the book to be published, they wanted people to go on tour to promote the book. He couldn't do it because he was in prison, so I was asked if I could be one of the people that went on the book tour. While I was touring on behalf of David Gilbert's book, the publishers that I was on the book tour with, Driving City to City, got to hear my story about being a Black skinhead and the anti-racist skinhead movement. And they were like, hey man, you should think about writing a book. So they informally offered me a book deal then. That was years and years ago. And I kept procrastinating. Over the last few years, I said, you know, I need to quit procrastinating and really commit to this. So I set out to capture the stories of some of the people I grew up with. And I went back to Chicago, went to Minneapolis, went to Atlanta, and I recorded the stories of a lot of the other Black skinheads, because people don't know that there were Black skinheads. They don't know the history and realize that the first skinheads were not racist at all. And that, in fact, there were a lot of Black skinheads. Some of the first skinheads were Black. And so in recording their stories for my book, I was gonna transcribe these interviews. Some colleagues that I worked with at KABU said, hey, you know those stories you're recording for your book? What if we turn some of those stories into a podcast and connected it to the history of anti-racist organizing in Portland specifically? Because there was a lot of connections between what we did in Minneapolis and what happened here in Portland in the 90s with the anti-racist action movement. So I said, sure. And so at that point, what I was working on for my book helped form the basis of the podcast that became It Did Happen. Mm-hmm. So the two projects are pretty intertwined.
That's cool. I had no idea the book was the mm-hmm. first thing, it's just, the first piece.
It's just that we finished the podcast because it's easier to record people.
Yeah. It's a lot quicker. That's true. You two, Nicole and Ayana, you might not know this, but actually that's part of the reason that this show ended up on KABU is that Erin Yankee was leaving, because Erin Yankee was one of the collaborators on It Did Happen Here. She's a friend of mine. And Erin was leaving KABU for a sabbatical to work on that podcast with Mike. And then I reached out and was like, hey, I have these young people that are really smart and great, and they're curious about art, and we're making this show. And so Aaron said, oh, actually, I'm leaving. There's the spot opening. Why don't you put it on the radio? And that's how we got here, which I kind of forgot about that like connection too. It's like everything, if you dig a little bit in the creative community in Portland, it's like all everybody's connected in all these ways.
Big shout out to Erin, because a lot of, you know, she was the one who initially approached me and said, hey, we've got these resources, and what do you think about taking your content and combining it with this project for the podcast? But she, her skills, you know, as a sound designer, are just incredible. And, you know, it really helped her and Icky layer the atmosphere of the podcast so that it's a richer experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really, I enjoyed listening to it. It's kind of a weird thing to say about that because it's pretty intense, but it's like, it's such a good listen. It's really well made. Yeah. Highly recommend anybody listening to this episode, go check out every episode of It Did Happen Here. Mm-hmm. We'll link to some stuff in the show page.
Yeah, I think it was really interesting. I only got a chance to listen to one episode, but being like a Oregon Portland native, it wasn't until like probably I want to say high schoolish that I learned that you know, we have a deep history of racism, and it wasn't until then that I started learning more and more about that. I think it's a really good listen if you aren't aware that we have that deep history here, and that it's still something that we're still like fighting to this day, and it's just not as prevalent as it was back then, which kind of leads me to a question that I had. Being that you were kind of here around like,
it's okay. We all know it's your dog. Okay. It's fine.
Yeah. being that you kind of have a different perspective of hearing people's stories and also living through it, how would you say that times have changed from how it was back then and how it is now for some of our younger audience?
I see the repeat of a lot of things. You know, there's always been racism in a different periods. The racism in this country and other forms of oppression too intersect and become more intensified. And we're seeing another iteration of that right now. These same things are going on in the 80s. And if you study history, then it's never that they weren't going on. It's just a matter of the type of exposure that these events and the people who were responsible for racial terror and different forms of oppression. There's just been different times where that's been more in the public eye or field of awareness. Right now, the reason that, you know, white supremacy and racism and different forms of fascism are so prevalent is because there's a broader social, political, economic context at this time in history. And we're seeing that people who once enjoyed a lot of material support for their privilege, a lot of that is going away because of the socioeconomic conditions that we face. And there's a lot of insecurity that's actually the result of capitalism and actually the result of white supremacist patriarchy. But instead of facing the truth that's at the root of those issues, it's easier for people to want a scapegoat and blame somebody else for those, their vanishing entitlement that they are scared to death of, really. And in the face of that fear, they're moved to violence and hate and a lot of rhetoric to try to influence people's thinking, you know? And it's sad, it's really sad, but it's something that's just part of reality here. There are parallels to it in other parts of the world as well. So it's just, I think it's just a matter of awareness. And the more we learn, the more we can start to understand that some of the things that we're just becoming aware of are part of longer historical continuum.
Yeah, it was interesting looking at some of your work, and again, I was also talking with Erica before this, that I'm learning about like different sort of how different groups of people are oppressed and discriminated against in our culture, and in this recent discussion we had, I noticed, like, you know, a lot of times there are people with higher power who allow these people to think that it's okay to behave certain ways and to think that it's okay to you know, like, hurt each other and just do all these bad things to each other, but in reality, like, it's not, and it's because these people aren't telling, aren't holding them accountable, or, like, there are people up with big power that are still saying, oh, it's okay, we're not gonna mention that. So it's just, like, it was so interesting to see all these different parallels that I see through sort of the education that I'm getting now, and like, what a lot of artists are, and activists as well, are fighting for. And yeah, I just wanted to mention that. I don't think I got a question out of that.
Yeah, it's true, though. You know, if we examine this whole debate around critical race theory, and even intersect that with voting rights, which is in the news a lot, it's a lot of that is around the people in power wanting large, like, mass amounts of the population to remain ignorant and emotional, you know, mm-hmm. and to be angry and fearful of some, you know, imaginary boogeyman or enemy. And that, in this country, that always means the marginalized people, you know, indigenous people, black people, women, sexual minorities, you know, poor people, mentally ill people. Those people are always going to be the scapegoat and the target to try to distract masses of people from understanding, like, actually, no, it's these corporate interests and the politicians that serve the corporate interests to protect private property and consolidation of wealth. That's always been the people who get away with murder. And it's only the ignorance and the misinformed that buy what those people are selling them, mm-hmm. you know, and the rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And that's what we see. And so the fight to keep masses of people uneducated is a huge weapon in keeping the same power, because the more informed people are, then the more critically they're going to assess and analyze their daily lives and be like, actually, it's not that guy's fault. Actually, it has nothing to do with the border. Mm-hmm. It has everything to do with the laws and our ability to actually change things with the vote or not, and our desire to get in the streets and demand change, you know, because if people are in the streets demanding reactionary consciousness, which means, like, that backwards stuff, you know what I'm saying? Like, let's not educate people. Let's not give women the right to choose. Let's make it harder for people who are non-binary to have human rights. Like, all that is actually going backwards. And it's funny to realize that the people who want to fight to go backwards are the ones who are most willing to employ violence. You know, that should tell you something right there.
Yeah, something, I mean, I appreciated that over and over again in the podcast. And it's so unfortunate to just hear that history and then also think about how similarly it played out to, you know, the last couple of years, you know, of protesting of like social upheaval that is, like, sort of has had a rise recently. But anyway, this idea of, like, the moderate or liberal sort of perspective trying to push back against that actually in the street reaction that people are having, that really justified reaction that everyone is having who's doing that more, like, public protesting, people who are doing things like, you know, there's a moment in the podcast where you, I think, are talking about, you know, countering hate graffiti with, like, counter graffiti that is, you know, anti-racist graffiti. And I think there's this thing in Portland right now, there's this real strain of people who are, you know, the graffiti abatement kind of idea, or the, like, you know, beautification idea, and the idea that, like, everything has to always be nice.
But everything isn't always nice. If you go to the streets and look at how many people have been thrust out of the economy and onto the sidewalk, you know, and that's violence. You see, when we have this conversation about violence, everybody wants to protect the system that uses violence as a tool to control the populace, to control people socially, economically, and politically. But instead of being critical of that, they want to be critical of the people who are in the street spray painting things, breaking windows. That's damage to property. But the reason they're in the streets is because you guys are actually killing human beings. You see what I'm saying? There's a difference. There's a huge difference between breaking a window or spray painting on something and getting away with murder time and time again. And what do you think that the cumulative impact of that trauma is on the people who are targeted? You know, so you don't, it's asymmetrical in the conversation. You know, the media does a lot of work, not community media, right? But corporate media does a lot of work to never ask the important questions. You know, they're almost encouraged. Well, they do. They actively encourage limited thinking and ignorance. And because that's where most people get their information from, we got people acting and thinking as if they're informed, but they're not. They're being misled.
Absolutely.
I actually have to go back to my deadline work.
Okay. Can we sneak in one last quick question from you?
Yes.
What advice would you have for any youth aspiring to just be either politically active or become a musician? Just kind of a general scope of what you've experienced. What advice do you have?
With being politically active, go deep. Always look for the root cause. That's what the term radical means. Because in order to eradicate, you have to go down to the root. You can't just pull off the leaf or, you know, the twig of the weed that you want to eradicate. So in terms of political consciousness, go deep and always look for the root cause. And then in terms of creative aspiration, go as high as you can go. Set your sights for the wildest dream you can possibly imagine, and then work for that, even if it takes you the rest of your life. Yeah.
Before we sort of click off, do you have anything that you would like to plug? Any future projects where we can find your work, and et cetera, et cetera?
So I'm on all the socials, you know, Twitter. I'm not on Twitter as much, but Instagram at Mike Crenshaw, MICCRENSHAW. Definitely go to the It Did Happen Here podcast, itdidhappenherepodcast.com, and check that out and share it with people. Stay tuned for an album I'm coming out with called Power to the Public. That's a collaboration with David Rovics and Adam Carpinelli, Michael Galen, and some other musicians. Our first single is going to be called Free Them All. And that's going to have a video. And it's about, you know, the fight to free political prisoners, featuring Opium Sabah. And then the Rebel Wise Project is on all platforms. So many good videos and such good music. Big shout out to Quincy Davis, my creative collaborator on Rebel Wise. And my recent release that hasn't had a lot of publicity, but you should check it out, is a rock collaboration with the Jai Marshall called Black Skinhead. And that's on Emergency Hearts Records. And we have you know, Born to Fight was the first single out of that. So if you go to YouTube and look for Mike Crenshaw, Born to Fight, you'll see that video. And then we've got a good one, a video going to be released in March from that album as well. So thanks for asking and thanks for having me. It was great talking to you guys.
Thank you, Mike. Really appreciate it. It's been so great to talk to you.
Thanks, Erica. Bye, Anna. Bye, Nicole.
Bye.
Bye.
What's the trauma doing in my head? Homicide, hunt me down and gun me down. Every time I go outside, choke the man to death in the light day. Shot that boy in his head and let his body lay. They afraid of me and I'm afraid to live. Aimlessly, courage, faith, and bravery. Let's evade slavery. Hunt you down, gun you down. Choking on your blood to drown. Maybe they will learn when the tables turn. Block the arteries and let the city burn. I have no choice, I have no voice, so I'm taking out the lights. You won't see me coming under cover of the night. They say they felt threatened and it justifies murder. They get acquitted, I don't forget it, in the streets I'm turner. They insincere and insecure and immature, nervous. Some of us try to organize, we're gonna die as certain. We make them rich and over fist the products that we purchase. The food we eat, the thoughts we think, we drink, it hurts us. All our lives we pay the price, I'm gone against the current. The systems weak, they face defeat, but that's beneath the surface. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, the whole world's blind and toothless. I want justice and I think there should be retribution. The police are a lynch mob, public executions. They operate above the law, brutal and abusive. Someone reform, what do we want? We want revolution. Freedom and democracy, you suffer that illusion. There will be blood, there will be death, there will be less confusion. Now there's violence daily and apparently we're losing. Riot is a language of the young. Lying in the flames and the thunder, tying in the chains that I'm under, suffering the pain and the hunger. Riot is the language of the younger. Lying in the flames and the thunder, tying in the chains that I'm under, suffering the pain and the hunger. Hush me with capital, try me. Trap is my radical, methods are tactical, highly. Talking about clapping, you do them like the Kennedys. Another black man trapping, you know that is not my enemy. Riot is a language of the younger. Lighting in the flames and the thunder. Tighten in the chains that I'm under. Suffering the pain and the hunger. Riot is a language of the younger. Lighting in the flames and the thunder. Tighten in the chains that I'm under. Suffering the pain. Imminent threat, infinite death, struggle. Never forget the blood that was shed so long. I never respect the system of stress, struggle. Victimization, prison and debt. Prolong, put my life on the line. Running out of time. They kill us, we take revenge, we kill them. Then they come for our family and friends. Once the cycle begins, it will never end. Until our sides quit the game and no one wins. No one wins, no one wins, no one wins.
Thank you. KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes 25 de enero del 2022. Pfizer y BioNTech han comenzado la inscripción para un ensayo clínico para probar la seguridad y la respuesta inmune de su